Hello and welcome to WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, Chris Weston and Matt D'Ancona.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode. You join us with Matt D'Ancona of Tortoise and various other publications and, of course, me and Matt, and we're here after another week of excitement and drama in football, cricket, which I'm trying not to think about, and work, I guess. Matt, how are you, Mr. Ballantyne?
Well, the kids are back at school. So I was thinking sort of slightly guiltily about the fact how I, you know, felt this joy that I would no longer have my children around me at home all day, every day. And I missed them a bit today as it was quiet around the house, but not that much, let's be true, you know. So that was good. I did my first lateral flow test, which it's a fascinating piece of user interface design though. So you've got this little plasticky device that's a little bit like a pregnancy test. And there's a long and convoluted exercise involving long swab. Everything's plastic and there's a huge amount of small bits of plastic going into landfill out of this, but I suppose it's worth it. You stick this swab up your nose and you stick it in your back of your throat and you have to stick it into a little plastic thing, which is like a pipette with some liquid in it that you stick there. Da, da, da. And then you put a couple of drops onto this, the lateral flow, presumably the movement of the liquid from one end of the piece of blotting paper to the other. And then there are two stripes, and one of them, if it comes on, it means the test has been correctly administered. The second one is that it means you've got coronavirus and therefore are to be thrown away from human civilization for 14 days. But the one that's the control to test that the test is working is marked C, and the other one is marked T for plague or something. But it's one of those things where you just go, oh, medical profession yet again have completely failed to understand the importance of user interface design, because how many people can see that C come up with a line against it and go, I've got coronavirus?
COVID! Yeah. Well, that reminds me, actually, there was a teardown on Twitter a few weeks ago, or maybe like last year, like a Twitter account called Foon, which is where, you know, one of those, it's a must-follow account. He's a good old techie. And he found out about these digital pregnancy tests. So the pregnancy test that you would normally see in Boots and whatever that you pee on and the line comes across in a similar sort of way, these are digital ones. But so he took one apart and found essentially what they've got is a little optical sensor which tells, and the lines are still in the test somewhere, but all it does is tries to figure out whether the line's gone or not. And then on a little screen says, yes, you're pregnant or not. So essentially it's just a little optical sensor to read the line. But, you know, in many ways that line sometimes is a bit faint or whatever. At least it gives you a yes or a no. Maybe that's what they need. Maybe that's the answer.
So you want plastic as well as electronics and batteries to go into landfill.
Whatever we can fling together in order to make this more complicated. Great move.
Anyway, Mr. D'Ancona, I think we're going to have to be formal tonight to be able to distinguish between the two of us.
Isn't it?
Matt, how are you? How's your week been?
Well, it's been, you know, occupied by sort of political stuff as usual, like the budget and what have you. But the main discovery I made this week is that the pandemic has to end soon. I think that's kind of my big kind of insight, which was that the other night I was doing an event at Jewish Book Fest. I wasn't actually doing it on my book. I was interviewing someone else. And we were on the stage at King's Place with no audience. And so the audience were watching online, completely empty, building completely empty, complete J.D. Ballard sort of dystopian scene. And I found the whole thing so madly exciting. You know, it was like Studio 54 for me, being with an author on a stage with absolutely no one in the room and everyone, you know, coming in with masks. And that was, to me, sort of so thrilling. I realise we're now reaching the point where if that's incredibly thrilling, it really is probably time to wrap this up, guys, because I badly need to get out.
It's done its job, basically.
I mean, I've got nothing against sitting in empty auditoriums, but and indeed have a certain amount of experience in that. But it never thrilled me so much. The sheer kind of adrenaline rush of sitting in an empty auditorium made me think that probably, certainly speaking entirely selfishly, it was time to, you know, get the vaccine rollout sorted and things back to something, not if not normal, then where I can go for a coffee or, you know, perhaps go to the movies. I realise it's not a very profound insight, and it may well have occurred to a few other people around the world, but certainly for me it was a big moment.
We don't need profundity, really.
I'm certainly not offering it, but I look back on the week that's passed, that was kind of the moment, the eureka moment.
I think, yeah, I had two similar moments actually this week. One was when I went to Sainsbury's at the weekend, and that just enough to be like, whoa. And then the other was I woke up after a vivid dream where I had dreamt that I was backstage at a big public performance by Bruno Brooks and Gary Davis in a shopping centre. And that was the point at which I went, God, I need this lockdown. So I've got something coming into my brain now other than just the memories of the late 80s and early 90s.
Yeah.
Terrifying.
Not sort of Spike Island, only not so much.
No, it was like in Westfield, and it was very drab. And I think I think it wasn't even in the late 80s or early 90s. It was kind of Gary Davis and Bruno Brooks today.
You need instant intervention here. If that's what's happening. I mean, I didn't take a pandemic for me to find out what it's like to stand and talk in front of a bunch of empty chairs, frankly. But that kind of experience, that would see me off, I think.
it was very strange.
How about you, Chris? Has anything happened in anything around your life in the last 7 days?
Well, yeah, I was looking forward to watching some cricket, but then I wasn't because that all went horribly wrong. I've been busy at work, and that's been quite good fun. Actually, it's been being busy is always good, but when you've got interesting things going on, it's even better. So that's okay. But no, not really, Matt. I wish I could say that it'd been that some grand thing had happened, but really we plod on, don't we? It was quite cold this week and quite dispiriting because I always get overexcited when the first rays of sunshine start dripping through the trees, and now it got cold again, so that puts me into something of a dudgeon, and I'm hoping that next week it gets a bit better and I can go outside a bit more.
Well, thanks for the warning that you're in a bad mood. This week's show, Matt has joined us because he's going to be talking about the book that he's got coming out a little later this month. So I think we should probably get on with that. So on the 18th of March, there is a new book coming out called Identity, Ignorance, Innovation. And it's your book, Matt.
It is.
We had the pleasure of reading it over the weekend. To start off, just tell us a bit about what those three I's are all about and why you've linked them together.
Well, I guess the genesis of the book was, oddly enough, it was during the Brexit period when I kind of reached the point where I could hear not a single further debate about immigration and how awful it was. And it seemed to me the whole country got stuck on immigration, almost as a proxy for change of any kind. You know, quite liberal always have been on immigration for all sorts of reasons, but economic and cultural. But in any case, it seemed that everything, all roads led to immigration. And I thought it'd be interesting to choose some other words beginning with I and just play around with them. And I came up with three, which were identity, ignorance, and innovation, which we can maybe go on and talk about. But the interesting thing, of course, was that I started writing the book and researching it, and then along came the pandemic, and that completely changed the context in which the book was written. But I suppose in ways that were pleasant, unsettling, and both, I found that it enhanced the themes and made me look at them afresh, and they seemed to me even more relevant. So it was sort of born in Brexit and birthed in Brexit and finally came to be properly in the age of COVID, which was a very strange writing experience. I mean, needless to say, I've never had anything like it before.
And the think about the three subjects individually. Yeah. So the first one, identity, and this is about quite a bit about identity politics, but it's more than just that.
Well, I mean, one of the principal purposes of this book, in a way, I mean, all books, however, whatever they are, all books have an element of autobiography in them. And this was, you know, I've always sort of occupied a kind of centre ground liberal position. And it seemed to me that a lot of people in that position, especially white people, were looking at white men, I should say, really, were looking at the identity politics movement as variously expressed in Black Lives Matter, Me Too, and so on, Extinction Rebellion, you name it, and being very dismissive of it and looking at it as a kind of series of pathological emergencies that were wouldn't last, or if they did last, it'd be very bad. Instead of saying, well, what's really going on here, and is there anything we can learn from it? And it seemed to me that a lot of what was being said in identity politics was really worth listening to and reflecting upon as a quite justified reproach to the kind of traditional liberal way of thinking and the assumption that the world operates on a fair and meritocratic basis, and that the systems of justice in the end will always operate reasonably well. And they don't, and they haven't. And a lot of identity politics in this decade coming is about the fact that it's taken so long for basic liberties and equalities to be distributed, and that using the new technologies, I guess, being a very important part of it, people have found it easier and easier to express their politics primarily, or at least partly, through group identity. And I think this is in many respects a positive thing, because it's brought to light the big gaps, the big failings. And I know a lot of liberal people disagree profoundly with this and see identity politics as a mortal threat to liberal institutions. But I think actually, if we do this intelligently, there's a lot to be learned from it and in it. Now, there's also some critique of identity politics in that section. It's not a sort of I don't just swallow it down in one gulp, but it's broadly positive. And I already talking to some people about, you know, the book coming up and so on, that has surprised people who, you know, I used to edit the Spectator magazine, and they say, what are you doing messing about with identity politics? You know, you're a 53-year-old straight white male. Why, you know, why are you doing this? And I think part of it is just that journalistic instinct, which is just you should remain curious, you should remain open-minded, you should be looking at the new and absorbing the best of the news. So that was very important to me, the first part. And it's kind of that, in a way, is the most deliberately the most combative section of the book. I want people of my generation to feel challenged by it, and I hope other generations will read it with interest too. But that there's definitely a kind of generational dimension to that. Ignorance was really to do with a kind of realization I had over a number of years that something was changing to the way knowledge was being both acquired and not acquired, and the role that examinations were playing in that. I'd seen my own children and other people's children and read about the situation in the States, and the way in which teaching to the test and the kind of manic formatting of the examination treadmill was really kind of now becoming hostile to the acquisition of knowledge. It was all about just being able to regurgitate things in tick box form. And this was not the original objective of standardized testing. You know, standardized testing came into vogue for other reasons, which were respectable, which was to try and raise standards. And as so often happens, social policy is born and it has its time. And I think we are now, one of the things that's very interesting about the pandemic, where in which essentially standardized testing has been put on hold, is that I hope there'll be a kind of rethink about how we test people. There'll always be some element of national standardized testing, I'm sure, but I hope that we'll shift away from the kind of that slightly frenzied obsession with these end of year examinations, on which we tell our children that everything hangs, you know, it's one strike or you're out, which is a very, very unhealthy way to acquire knowledge, and probably not in a way to acquire knowledge at all, at precisely the time when we need people to be able to have as broad a range of knowledge as possible, and to be able to think critically and creatively, to be able to understand the liberal arts and, heaven help us, the sciences. You know, this great divide we still have in this country between the humanities and STEM subjects, science subjects and maths, very unhealthy, and really bears little relevance to not just the workforce, not just the world of work into which kids are going to be going, but the world. You know, we're going to be living in a world in which we are already bombarded with information, and we need the skills, the digital literacy to understand it. We need the attention span to absorb information and knowledge, the space to have curiosity. This is one of my big bugbears, is that children, there's a terrible word used in syllabuses called enrichment, which sort of means, you know, that after you've been force-fed like a goose, you know, being prepared for foie gras, you're allowed 25 minutes to talk about, you know, a play or a book or a pop song or, you know, rap lyrics that interest you before you're sent back to the factory farm. And I think it's very sad, because I think, you know, when you're young, there should be some slack in the system to enable you to roam and explore. And, you know, I think that people should have a very broad and eclectic approach to culture. I think it's great to encourage kids to, you know, watch art house movies, but also when they want to talk about gaming, not to treat them as idiots, because gaming is dominant, you know, possibly one could argue the dominant force in global culture now. And I think we have to be much more imaginative in our approach to knowledge. So ignorance was that was sort of the second big theme that I wanted to take on. Innovation was, and innovation became more important in the pandemic, I suppose, which was really, how do we live in a world of change? You know, how do we make ourselves resilient in a world of change? And so I selected a number of kinds of change: automation, growing life expectancy, the problem of misinformation, and so on, and just took each of them as a sort of example of how it might be possible to become more resilient, because these are forces that are going to be, you know, more and more important in the years to come. It could have, you know, could have just as easily looked at pandemic issues, virology, and so on. I mean, I only selected a few just as examples, but I just wanted to take those three big themes and knit them together as a kind of offering towards a new politics, because I think as we come out of the pandemic, there's going to be a huge appetite for new ideas. And I've been writing about politics a while now, and to be honest, I can't remember a moment when the sort of intellectual landscape was so arid. You know, it's not fizzing with any great big themes. There are great movements out there, great sort of campaigns and so on, but what you don't have is a sense of, you know, where the heat and the energy is going to gather in politics itself. So this is my little contribution to that big debate that I hope will begin, you know, when we're sort of finally released from our quarantine.
With the identity section, some of the things you described there, it feels almost that identity politics is just one facet of how, particularly, I guess, social networks are starting to challenge established structures for organisations. So the way in which, for example, I find now often that networks exist that span across organisations with people with interest, some sort of common interest, communities that span across, that can organise and be able to manage themselves in a way that they just couldn't have done even maybe 10 years ago, are now often actually much more powerful for getting things done and things to happen than those that exist within an organisation. Take, for example, experience of working in digital services within government. Whilst government digital service in the UK was a catalyst, actually there's a whole load of, you know, gov camps and, you know, open forums and stuff that sit across government organisations, where you've got people who are affecting change much more effectively across their discipline or across the thing they want to talk about than they would if they were just stuck in a silo of a particular government department or a particular arm's length body. And that, I don't think it's limited to the public sector at all. I think that you can see those kind of waves happening in all sorts of places. And so there's something here about how our means individually to communicate are starting to really challenge the traditional hierarchies of traditional organisations, maybe?
Yeah, no, totally. And I think that there's a risk sometimes of loose language. When we talk about social networks, we confuse that with big tech and the arguments about big tech and whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, and it quickly degenerates into an argument about Facebook and Twitter. But actually, as sort of social phenomena, social networks, I think, have been, you know, a net good by some margin. And, you know, one of the things I look at in the book is the difference between networks and institutions, and how people have lost lost trust in institutions in the last 20, 25 years for all sorts of reasons. But also technology has enabled them to, as you say, Matt, you know, to find their own peer groups and to be very creative and sometimes healthily disruptive in their fields. I always remember Eric Raymond, the coder, I think back as far back as 98, started talking about the cathedral versus the bazaar. You know, the idea that the old world was a world in which there was a cathedral that everyone worshipped in, which was the sort of the institution of authority, and that the web, as it then was, because this was, you know, pre-social media, pre-broadband, was going to bring in a world where it was more like a big shopping bazaar of activity and excitement. And he was right. You know, absolutely, that is what has happened. And, you know, if you look at politics, the most powerful institution now is the WhatsApp group, without question. And this is much criticized by some people, but actually it's enabled, you know, people both in campaigns and in parliament to liaise with each other, to interact with each other when they're not physically near one another in a way that, you know, again, is a net positive. And I think that's good. And I think it can be good in any context, to be honest, professional particularly. You know, you can see how creative those networks are, because they're not built on a deferential model. They're built on a kind of lateral model of mutual respect and understanding. Now, sometimes they break down, of course, like all networks do, but that's not a new phenomenon. It's just the case that sometimes things don't work out, but actually the opportunity, I think, is enhanced. And that's the key, is that the opportunity is greater than it was.
Do you think that's, I would say that in my experience over the years, talking about that cathedral versus bazaar idea, the number of organisations, there are still those that kind of talk kind of ex cathedra, if you know what it is. So this is how it is. And they're telling you that what their opinion is the opinion. And there are organisations in my industry, you know, that do that. But they're getting fewer and further between, because it's not possible to be quite so prescriptive anymore. It's not possible to be the one source of truth, because there are so many ways for that to be challenged and so many other avenues for people to get valuable and valued information.
I mean, the upside of that's huge, because it means that the means of production, as it were, have gone out of a very few people's hands into everyone's hands. You know, when I started as a journalist in 1991, I was at the Times and as a trainee, and you know, literally the journalists would flock in to the plant in the morning, and in the evening, huge trucks with the Sun and the Times written on the side would come out with the newspapers on it. I mean, it was a completely Fordist model. And I mean, that was ex cathedra, literally. You know, the editorials that were written at the paper were the expressions of, I guess, you know, it wasn't even an elite view, it was an establishment view that really had enormous authority and power. You compare it to now, everyone can do that, you know, at vanishingly small cost, zero cost. And I think that's a good thing. I think I'm radically in favor of that. The only problem, and it, you know, it can be a huge problem, is the other kind of authority, which is not power over people, but the authority that comes from being a trusted source. And so I think the new challenge, which has been wrapped, the last book I wrote was about post-truth, and I address misinformation in this one too, is how do you kind of ensure that a world in which information is flat, that you're not exposed to pseudoscience, or if you are, that you know that you are being so exposed, and you understand that Holocaust denial is rubbish and that kind of thing. And this is, it's an educational challenge, it's a challenge of kite marking, it's a huge test for the tech companies themselves. And I kind of feel we're only in the foothills of this. People want big bang answers, and that's understandable. And there's no doubt that legislation and regulation will play its part in it. But we need to sort of slightly hold our nerve on this one, because it is true that at the moment, you know, things are not, there isn't an answer to that clear and present danger. And it is deeply worrying that America is full of people who still seem to believe in QAnon, and conspiracy theories generally, and the hold they have over people is an alarming byproduct of all this. But still and all, I think that the new information ecosphere is better than what preceded it. And we will find ways through human ingenuity of improving our, you know, our kind of information nutrition, if you like, and understanding, you know, what it is we put into our minds and how to sort that. But that's really what people should be thinking about. I mean, again, my sort of footnote worry is that there are very, very, very few politicians who understand this. I remember when I mentioned it in the book, when Carol Cadwalader, the great campaigning journalist on all this, and I went to testify to the Culture and Media Select Committee, which was doing a review under Damien Collins, who does understand all this, but not all of his fellow MPs understood much about anything. And what struck me most about our period of being cross-examined was an MP who shall remain nameless, because it was in private, asking me what an app was. And this was not that long ago. And I thought that's terrifying, because it's not as if that's not a high-tech question.
But I think there's two sets of knowledge, and I don't think this is just politicians. I think there are a lot of senior people in organisations and possibly the population at large. But in senior ranks, I think this is particularly the case. The one side of it is understanding technology, the kind of engineering and the way it works and how it works and what this stuff is. And it's I kind of vacillate between thinking that actually you do need to know some of this stuff to be able to make sensible decisions. And actually, I don't really know roughly above and beyond very little how a car works, but it gets me from A to Z. So do I need to worry about it? And I can see pros and cons either way. The other side of it, though, for me, and again, this might be because of my own background, having studied both of these areas, but the much derided subject of media studies, which was kind of in certainly when I was going to university in the late 80s, early 90s, was seen as a, no pun intended, Mickey Mouse subject. But actually being able to have the cognitive understanding of being able to understand the media as well as the content within it, so that you can start to be able to make those decisions about what is valuable and what is not. And if you don't have either of those, if you understand neither the tech nor the mechanisms by which media operates, you're going to believe anything.
Well, that's so true, and you know, I think it's very striking to me when I go and talk at schools and so on, that, I mean, the first thing that strikes me is that the old media world is just dead, in the sense that, you know, you can be talking to a very bright group of kids and chat to them before, and they're obviously bright as buttons and, you know, really switched on, and they get talking about the issues that animate them. So the kind of kickoff question is, well, who's read? And then I'll reel off the BBC, The Guardian, you know, a few kind of basic mainstream media sources, you know, online today. And very few of them will put their hands up. You know, they're getting their information from social media and YouTube, interestingly enough. I'm always fascinated by the power of YouTube with the young as an information provider. It's very underrated. And what I think you have now is that their teachers are of a generation that, you know, through no fault of their own, are not equipped to teach them the digital literacy they need to understand that they're being fed by algorithm rather than by veracity. I mean, the stuff they get is based upon their previous likes and their what they enjoy, and so their confirmation bias is etched into the system. And this is, you know, just the start of the process you're talking about, Matt. And I think it's incredibly important, and the sooner that happens, the better. I mean, I'm very much in favour of throwing money at this, actually, and you know, if necessary, you know, a windfall tax on big tech, or a small levy on every handset, something like that, that would just generate a big pot of cash that could be spent on helping teachers to learn how to do this, because it's so important. It's kind of, but it's basic civic empowerment. You know, if you're not able to distinguish the good from the bad, if you're not able to see what's real and what isn't, and what's opinion and what's factually based, and not able to cross-examine and interrogate what you're fed, you are going to just end up in a sort of cantonized, tribalized world where you're just huddling around a series of certainties which may or may not be the case. And that is a problem. But again, you know, I think, you know, we can fix it. I don't think that the problem is in any sense unfixable. It just requires a bit of energy and a lot of imagination. And so, and one of the themes that goes through the book is a kind of impatience with populist governments, because I think populist governments are very, very good at complaining about problems and very, very bad at fixing them. They insist that there are simple solutions to complex problems, but that wicked elites thwart those simple solutions, and immigrants and all manner of imagined enemies, including the mainstream media, stand in the way. And what's, you know, really striking about populist governments is they're not actually very good at doing stuff. That if you look at the Trump administration, it didn't really do very much, which is probably for the best, but it didn't really accomplish anything. And if you look at the Johnson government, its first year with the pandemic was a series of catastrophes. And one of the reasons that we're all so blown away by vaccine rollout is that it's the first time that the thing has worked. And thank goodness it is. But, you know, it is, we're all sort of blinking and scratching our eyes and thinking, how did that happen? And hoping that it's not some terrible cosmic mistake. And we're in a multiverse and we'll bounce back to the real Johnson universe, where vaccine rollout is a complete disaster and everyone's getting the wrong doses. And, you know, it is rather amazing that people are quite as amazed as they are. And that's because the populist governments are not, you know, they're great at campaigning. You have to give it to Boris Johnson and to a certain extent Trump, you know, who you know, he didn't lose by that much. They're amazing at campaigning, winning referendums, winning elections, that kind of thing. But when it comes to governing countries, they're completely terrible. And so this is, as they say in Whitehall, a suboptimal moment, because we've got big problems, some of them very nuanced and technical, and we need governments that are ready to take them on, you know, with energy. I don't mean technocratic governments, I mean passionate governments. But populism is not passion, populism is about getting power and keeping it, using popular support as your glue. It's a different thing.
Do you think sometimes, if you think about that populist ideal of it's all just about making a simple answer to things, that'll all do, I wonder sometimes, actually, is the tech industry an example of that, where the answer will be tech, and then we don't have to worry about any of the hard bit. We don't have to worry about getting people to change, because we just put some tech in. If you think about the early days of the pandemic, for example, it was going to be the app that was going to save us. Now, the app is all gone a bit quiet about the app, because the app...
Yes, it has, hasn't it?
Yeah. But the tech can actually fulfil that role of being the populist answer to stuff, and it doesn't actually achieve it necessarily. There's a in the innovation agenda stuff, so there's a real risk there, I think.
I think it's an abuse of what technology is, which is to, exactly as you say, to imply that it's magic. And you know, you've got a problem as socially complex as test, trace, and isolate, and you appeal to people's love of their phones, basically. You know, the phone is the modern amulet. You know, it's the superhero amulet. It's full of magic. People can't bear to let go of it. It's their precious, you know. And so people are thinking, well, how is this test, trace, and isolate going to work? That sounds complicated. And Matt Hancock says, we've got an app and possibly several. And they say, great, we'll have them all. And then none of them work. And actually, that was a very good example of technology was kind of like the Wizard of Oz, the curtain behind which the Wizard of Oz hid, but except the Wizard of Oz was sort of out of work telesales person who was meant to be tracing people and spoke to two people in 10 hours. I mean, it really was, in years to come, that policy will be studied as how not to do anything ever. It's an incredible example of how to do things badly. But to your point, the app with a capital A was the magical potion, wasn't it? It really was. And that's, I think part of this is to stop talking about technology as a separate thing, because I think what we characterize as the digital revolution is now everything, really. Nothing is divorced from it. And so when you hear people saying there are technological solutions to this, I share your kind of suspicion. Something is up here. This is a poker player's tell, because there are technological solutions to absolutely everything. And the pandemic has illustrated that par excellence. Who really knew what Zoom was? Who wants to use Zoom ever again? It's kind of been one of the great features of the last year. But it's speaking about tech as a separate entity, I think, just deludes people into thinking that it's kind of almost like a commodity that they can get hold of, or a tribal magic they can tap into, when it's no such thing. I mean, it is now the infrastructure of what it is to be human.
But you mentioned in your book, you mentioned that, I can't remember where the research came from, or whether it's just a truism, I don't know, but this idea that innovation is overestimated in the short term and underestimated in the long term. And what we're talking about is that first piece, aren't we? We're talking about people overstating the impact of tech, in this case, or an app or whatever, in the short term. In the past, we talked about reading people like Dominic Cummings's interminable blogs, and he kind of gets this to this point where he can fix everything because it's all worked out. When it's too complex. It's way more complex than he realizes, but he comes up against the limits of his imagination, because he sees this kind of, he gets blinded by the tech, or every single time. And I remember reading a book by a journalist who got into the AI and singularity and the rationalist community. And the more I read it, the more frustrated I got with the kind of credulousness of this, of listening to those bollocks and thinking there was anything in it at all. It's like people are just enraptured by this stuff.
Well, that's a very good word for it, because there is a religiosity to it. And I have a smidgen of sympathy, because it is an exciting time to be alive in the sense that you're watching, you know, I'm sure people in the past have always felt this when they're going through a technological revolution that's really transformative. That print, I imagine, was the same, 16th century, electricity and so on and so on. And this is one that, you know, it is extraordinary and thrilling and occasionally scary to live through. But certainly the idea that you know, you throw tech at a problem because it's too complicated for civil servants to understand was a damaging one. I mean, the interesting thing about Dominic Cummings was that he managed to cultivate the image of a kind of scary, very clever, bullying character who kind of prowled the corridors of Whitehall, terrifying people and running Britain while Boris Johnson sort of bumbled around. Actually, the real model for Dominic Cummings is from the thick of it. If you remember Julius Nicholson, the guy who Tucker was always mocking because he was bouncing from department to department, and Malcolm Tucker would say, you know, what was he doing today? He was designing a department to count the moon. And actually, that's exactly what Cummings was doing, almost literally, that while we were in the middle of this terrifying pandemic with 1,000 people plus dying a day, Cummings was busy doing schematics for his version of Mission Control in the Cabinet Office. That was a kind of, he was going to turn big rooms in the Cabinet Office into a kind of Mission Control, from which he would presumably run Britain as if it was one of the early Apollo missions. And you know, exciting as that might be, it probably wasn't the best use of the government, of the Prime Minister's chief advisor's time in the middle of, you know, a global plague. But that's what he liked to do. You know, it always involved a book, usually obscure, and it always involved abusing civil servants, and it always involved an idea of total obscurity. And actually, that the absence of someone who talks rubbish is always to be celebrated. And that's really the great thing about Cummings having gone, is that, you know, people who are trying to kind of hold the government together no longer have to deal with this in their ear every morning and need it late at night.
Yeah. Well, you know, the fact that, but you could see everything you wrote, you believed all this crap. And it's so easy to get enraptured or to be sucked in by it. And in fact, what happens is this idea that innovation has a longer term effect. We had a guy on a podcast a few weeks ago, Anthony Slumbers, who talks about prop tech and property. And we were talking about the city, and he was saying, well, actually, you know, it doesn't really matter that it won't be that everybody doesn't go back to work. You only need a certain amount. You know, Amazon, by taking 15% of retail, has created tipping points throughout the retail industry. And that's all you need. And that's really, I think that plays into this piece as well about the tech doesn't have to be revolutionary. It doesn't have to change everything in the way that we sometimes think that it's going to happen. This massive change will happen. It just needs to hit a series of tipping points in different areas to have a long-term effect.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's very important to maintain human agency in our relationship with tech. I think we're very seduced by the idea of the algorithm and you know, big tech's desperation to keep hold of its intellectual property has encouraged the idea that the algorithm is something very, very, very special and secret in a black box somewhere in California that no one is allowed to look at except Mark Zuckerberg on a Thursday or whatever. And this is a ridiculous approach to technology. You know, and algorithms long predated digital technology, and you know, it's just maths, it's just code. And I think that demystifying the algorithm is going to be very important in all of this. And I do think every child should have at least a rudimentary understanding of that. I don't think every child has to be a coder, but I do think understanding the power of the algorithm, how it's going to develop, how it's going to teach itself as AI becomes more important. That's much more important than the kind of Ray Kurzweil singularity rubbish about, you know, consciousness and kind of it's almost like a Timothy Leary 1960s psychedelia, really, with a bit of, you know, loaded onto a MacBook. I mean, that's really all it amounts to. But it is very, very, it is amazing how infectious it is, and how you see that sort of slightly the thousand yard stare in people's eyes as they start to talk about it, you know, and off they go. And it really is. I mean, I'm by no means a technologist at all, but I could tell sort of not long into Kurzweil's book on the singularity that it was rubbish, and it was quite alarming how it sort of acquired this mystique, because there's nothing mystical about it at all. But we go back to the old Arthur C. Clarke thing about the partition between technology and magic always being, you know, a porous one, and how that's always been the case.
Well, to finish up then, if we think about these ignorance gaps amongst, it's one thing for kids to be taught in, you know, critical thinking and to be able to understand what media channels are about and how algorithms work and not necessarily need to know coding and all of that. What about for people who are actually in power today, though? What would help us in terms of being able to get an understanding at senior levels in politics and in business that's missing at the moment, do you think?
Well, I think, you know, I do think that as longevity, and not just life expectancy, not just remaining alive longer, but actually working and living and, you know, enjoying a recreational life for a much longer time, has transformed everything anyway, and means that, you know, we're all going to be working longer, and we're all going to have to think harder about what our roles are, because, you know, people. You know, it's quite possible that people will want to carry on working in some way if they're fit until into their 80s. But it's ridiculous to suggest that they should remain in leadership roles until they're 85. I mean, there'll have to be some sort of renewed intergenerational social contract where older people perform different roles. So I think that, you know, that's a very interesting and open question. But also, the old model of living was that you did your learning, which involved, you know, either sort of going off and getting a degree or acquiring some sort of technical or vocational skill, and then you did your career, and then you retired, and then you died very quickly, and everything was kind of wrapped up in, you know, 70 years. And that's just not the model anymore. Add to that the fact that the old-fashioned career is in pieces anyway, and that the pace of technology means that we have to continuously learn new stuff. We're going to have to, to your question, Matt, about the, you know, older people, you know, I've been thinking about this myself, you know, what if I could take 6 months off and go off and learn something, what would be really interesting to go off and learn, you know, what would be useful? And I thought that when I when I left, I had a brief period in academia, and you know, when I left that, I thought, well, this is it, that's it, I'm done with the world of learning. It was great fun, but now I'm off to do the working bit, and then I'll do the retiring bit, and then I'll die. And it's a bit more complicated than that. So persuading this generation, I'm 53, and my generation are probably the last, I think, who will be really hard to persuade to learn, you know, in middle age. But if it was possible, if companies and employers could find ways, maybe through tax breaks and so on, to enable people to go off and dreadful word, upskill or reskill, but to do it intensively and properly, it would be transformative, because someone by the time they're in their 50s, you know, is pretty good at understanding what they need to learn. I mean, you're better at learning in a funny way than you were when you were 18. You may have lots of set ideas, that's true, but you've learned how to husband your time and how to work out what the nature of the problem is. And so I think it'd be thrilling to do that now. And I would welcome a world of work and of a culture in which it wasn't seen as odd. So I mean, at the moment, the only things you can really do, I guess, is go off and do an MBA, or, you know, some people go off and do a doctorate or something like that. But just to actually go off from your job for 6 months and acquire a skill that would enable you to come back and maybe reconfigure that job in an exciting way, that's something that we're nowhere near embracing. And I think it would be brilliant. I think it would make being middle-aged much more exciting. It would enrich the workplace, you know, and it would mean that the arc of a working life wasn't quite so predictable, which I think is I like and I find very exciting as a prospect. But this is all to do with human agency and making it happen. There are no predictabilities in this at all. I don't trust market forces just to make it happen. I think it requires management to think in a way that thus far they haven't.
Well, that brings us to the end of another show. We will put a link to Matt's book on the website at wb40podcast.com, where you'll be able to no doubt pre-order it. And it's well worth a read. And thanks for coming on, Matt, to talk about it. What's the week ahead looking like for you?
I've got a lot of movies to watch, because one of the things I do for Tortoise is I write a weekly cultural newsletter, which is actually just an excuse for me to watch lots of films and stream lots of TV and stuff and read books that are interesting. So the next few days, I've got a huge pile, backlog of stuff I've got to get through, which I'm rather excited about. And then I thought at the weekend I might, you know, if I can find an empty auditorium somewhere, I might just go for the double to see if I can do it on my own this time. It's living the dream.
Fabulous. And Chris, have you got anything other than the usual ahead?
No, not at all. I've got a really busy week. I'm a little bit, I'm not exactly stressed out about it, but I can almost visualise my Outlook calendar and all the things that I need to get done, which doesn't fill me with a great deal of pleasure, except that actually they're all okay things. I just know they've got to get done, and I don't like the idea that I've got lots of work to do. It's not really civilised, so I need to get through that. But it's going to be a busy week. What about you, Matt?
We're running a hack week, and not like a coding hack week, but trying to be able to apply some principles of service design, which we're trying to be able to deploy across our organisation as a whole within what we do as a technology team within the organisation. So we had the first session today, and there's going to be running with kind of an hour and a half each day over the 5 days. So hopefully, A, I can get my team to be able to experience what it is to start with the needs of your customers and then design from there. And secondly, hopefully be able to find some things that we can do differently to make the services we deliver to our internal customers better. So that's kind of a bit of a difference to the week as a result of that. Other than that, chugging through the procurement exercise at the moment and marvelling at the irony that the supplier who we are having to make this whole procurement happen because of their late delivery of updates to their software have delayed the entire process by the late delivery of their non-disclosure agreement. So, honestly, software companies. But there we go. Anyway, wonderful to have you on, Matt. Thank you again for joining
us. Thank you very much.
Delight.
Great.
And next week we will be joined by the inimitable Marcus John Henry Brown, who is going to be talking about how to present and perform during lockdown. So until then, have a great week.
Thank you for listening to WB40. You can find us on the internet at WB40podcast.com, on Twitter at WB40podcast, and on all good podcasting platforms.